the Chilpak Hollywood Lawsuit of the Week, the Chilpak Hollywood Wingnut of the Week, the Chilpak Hollywood Live Event of the Week, the Chilpak Hollywood Explanation of the Week, celebrity deaths, and school closings will not be heard this week so that we may bring you the following special installment of your Chilpak Hollywood Hour. And it will begin with bongos.
Chilpak Hollywood Hour, Top 10, with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Awesome.
No, that is true.
Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund in the Office of Rational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia. I'm Dean Haglund. This is your Chilpak Hollywood Hour, and I'm here with your co-host, Mr. Phil Lairness, ladies and gentlemen.
I like that, Dean Haglund, we're less than 2 minutes into the show, and already your name has been mentioned four times. Mine has been mentioned twice.
Yes. And we're in a hurry.
What more do you need? We're in a hurry. So we should mention our names a few more times to get those out of the way.
Right, and then go.
Hey, we have a very special installment.
I know.
An annual installment of everybody's Chilpak Hollywood Hour. The top 10 films of the year that was. We take a look back at the year it was for the top 10 films. We do have one bit of business we would be remiss in ignoring.
And
that is wishing happy birthday to our friend and one of the best guests we've ever had on your Chilpak Hollywood Hour, Mr. Chris Jacobs.
Chris Jacobs.
Host of Entertainment Tonight.
Is it his birthday today?
In show business news, Chris Jacobs turns 20-something years old today.
Which host of Entertainment Weekly turns
tonight.
Something...
Entertainment Tonight.
Oh, tonight, yes. Yeah. Not Entertainment Weekly.
Being a host of Entertainment Weekly is really, really a bad gig.
Totally, because you have to come to my bathroom and where all my Entertainment Weeklies are.
Yes, you have... whoever that host is, they have hosted several satisfying trips to Dean's bathroom.
How embarrassing for that person. Yeah. Good one. Anyway, yes, this is the show I've been dreading because, of course, I barely saw 10 films this year. You know, it's been very busy for Mr. Dean Haglund. Traveling around the world, seeing Australia, wow. Many a convention. I didn't really have time to just lollygag like you do.
Oh, my goodness.
Going out every night,
wow.
Just sort of relaxing in a big screen theater at the DGA as you do.
Actually, I saw films in fewer venues than I probably had in any year.
And why not? Because you had it worked out to a science.
Well, it's just that I do see so many things in advance at the Directors Guild.
Right, for free.
And then there's a few venues where I did see things.
Right.
I try sometimes when I'm at film festivals to see things.
Good for you.
One of the films that is on my top 10 list for 2011, I saw at a film festival.
Look at you.
Before it got a theatrical release. And... But it comes down to getting smarter in my ability to see these things. Now,
right. The
thing is, though, is it gets easier to see things. I made my New Year's resolution to see every one of the 32 films on the Metacritic consensus list.
Right.
By the way, see everything on Josh Glasgow's top 10 list from Glasgow to the movies, and then some other films that I felt I needed to catch up on.
Right.
I did not fulfill that resolution. I came darn close, though. I mean, I have seen 10 films in the last week.
Really?
And it becomes easier, and this is where I was going with this, because of the early availability of things on DVD,
yep.
Because of their availability so often on streaming through different websites,
sure.
Netflix, Amazon, HD Cinema, Cinema Now. How about VOD? Many of the films are available on VOD before or during their theatrical run.
I'm not going to lie to you.
So there's more and more ways to see films. There's more and more ways to see everything. As a result, more and more films get released. And on a year like this, where such a high percentage of them were actually worth watching, it becomes almost overwhelming. And so I thought going into January, I was in great shape. I already had 25 films that could have made a top 10 list.
You think?
And then I looked at the 30 or the 40 that I still wanted to see before I could make those decisions. And so I did my level best, sir.
Damn it.
To catch up on things.
Well, that's very good of you. I was fortunate. I had a couple of Screen Actor Guild screeners being mailed to me, which I managed to jam into my computer and have a look-see. Other than that,
I would like to point out that, you know, each week we do a blog over on MySpace previewing the forthcoming Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Yep.
And the preview takes on really a form of its own each week. There
of course.
There is no, just like each show probably differs from many of the other shows, so too does each. You have to, just to keep your sanity, you got to make them unique. This week, what we did, you and I.
Yeah, I remember it
was,
well.
We started our list. I think we began with descriptions of 10 of the most overlooked films of 2011. And we'll be adding some films to that list through the next coming week. So if you haven't checked out that blog, we encourage you to do so. Again, it's myspace.com/chillpackhollywood. And in fact, I am going to eventually get that blog posted on chillpackhollywood.com.
Really?
And our WordPress site, and I think it would behoove us. And so this is New Year's resolution.
Fantastic.
Once a month, there will be a blog posting on Chilpack Hollywood Hour's website, chillpackhollywood.com, all about the movies
that you should see.
And I think, or just about different topics of the movies. Maybe a further discussion of some of the topics that come up on this show.
Fantastic.
And we will call that your Chilpack Hollywood Hour Movie Lover's Companion.
Because
it's not required reading.
No.
It's extra.
Extra.
If you would like to learn more about the issues you saw in today's after school special, here we suggest you go.
I know. And I know exactly overlooked films, too, that I somehow just did not stay in the theaters that long. One being Cave of Forgotten Dreams. I don't know if that's on your list.
That's not overlooked because when it wins a lot of awards and makes the most money at the box office of any documentary in the year, I don't consider that overlooked.
Okay, overlooked by me. I didn't get to it.
This was, as you know, not what we did on the blog. We decided to take to task in the blog was this idea that 2011 was a weak year for films. It's something we've been hearing a great deal, and it's understandable if you look at maybe the top 30 films at the box office.
Right.
And you go, there are very few here that feel like they will become all-time favorites.
Right.
And if you look at the 9 films nominated for Best Picture, there's really only a few that seem to have a chance to ever go down in history as all-time classics.
Right.
And then, oh my goodness, if you look at the year that the industry had, the 4-month box office slump, all the problems within the industry concerning the death of outmoded distribution models,
right,
and fear and lack of understanding about new distribution apparatus
and what the kids want to see.
There's so much uncertainty that you can understand why people would want to dismiss the year as just, it was such a bad year.
Right.
But as we wrote on the blog, that would be to overlook one really important group, which is the filmmakers around the world who, in greater numbers than any year I have been alive, got quality films released.
Right.
So it raised this question of perhaps what we're looking at is it was a weak year because so many of the really good films were so easily overlooked or lost or fell through the cracks. And in taking the time to describe these films, describe why they're films that might be worth people's time, we also tried to assess maybe why they were overlooked.
Right.
What led to them being overlooked.
Right. And not just my time schedule.
Yeah, Teen's time schedule was not
one of the issues.
An excuse that we leveled on a global scale. towards. And of course, by the way, saying that these are overlooked, it's overlooked through the perspective of, well, first of all, us, but also in the U.S.
Right. That's right.
You know, because that doesn't mean that they were overlooked everywhere. Sure. The importance, if we can call it that, of a film being overlooked in the U.S. is that no matter where that film originated, no matter where it was made, if it was a film from a foreign land, it probably got good distribution in that foreign land. But the movie industry internationally still tends to operate with a particular rule of thumb that a film needs to have a significant release in the U.S., no matter from where it might originate, in order for it to get distribution in other parts of the world.
Right, for global distribution to happen.
There are so many film quotas, there's import quotas, there's all these things, and again, there's only so much distribution money, purchasing money, marketing money around the world.
Right.
And if a film made traction in the U.S. because of how much media attention we give to the entertainment industry and how much money we have to market it, part of their marketing, an important part of their marketing in other territories, is already done.
Right.
Big it's hit in the States.
Right. Come see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because you've already heard about it because you're reading global,
right. What,
you know, the global reach of the entertainment magazines, like my Entertainment Weekly in the bathroom. I mean, that's global.
That's twice. The one in the bathroom is global.
That's the one. Because when I flush it down the toilet, I don't know where that goes.
Flush locally, read globally. That's the bumper sticker that I've always admired that you have on your easel. So are there any other than the fact that you're really busy?
Yep.
Are there any other caveats to your top 10 list?
Well, you know, I also, for our sister website, the Comedy Film Nerds, I'm a reviewer when I get a chance. So every film I do see, I write a review for. And occasionally they ask me to go to one or two films that I really regret going to. And so in that caveat, the reason I didn't see more great films that I wanted to see was I had to see a couple real stinkers for the website.
You know, this actually is something I was thinking about on the way here. About, again, why might the year that was being determined as a bad year by so many, and then for me being overwhelmed by how many good choices there were.
Right.
You know, how that differing opinion. It does seem to me that for many of us, when you see a bad film, or you see a couple bad films in a row.
Holy smokes.
It really, for most people, I think it takes away the appetite for a while.
Takes the wind out of your sails.
It's not that you don't love movies anymore, but quite frankly, why not just rewatch something that you've already enjoyed?
Absolutely. You know, I say there's a parallel between this and stand-up comedy in the 90s. Because if you remember when cable first blew up, A&E had Evening at the Improv, and suddenly every cable network had a brick wall and a really unfunny comic, which then decimated the comedy industry because nobody went to the clubs anymore because they went, oh yeah, I watched some of that on TV. It's not funny. And you go, well, it's not funny because they're just picking out whoever's near the camera to go do stand-up. They're not picking the best comics that have honed their act for months or years on the road. So invariably, it decimated the live event because TV oversaturated the market. I think the similar thing happens in the movies. If you see two or three real crap things in a row, you go, yeah, I go to movies, I pay a lot, and they're all horrible, so I don't go anymore.
Right.
Even though there's probably, you know, you're just not picking them, or you're believing whatever crap press, pre-press is out there.
And after all, as we've talked about so many times on this, one of the biggest components as to how you enjoy something is what your expectations are going into it.
Right.
Are you getting what you expect? Are you someone who likes to get what you expect? Or do you like to be surprised? How much are those expectations setting up an energetic that opens you to enjoyment?
Right.
A couple in a row, you know, if you go into a movie hoping, God, I hope I haven't made another mistake on this one. I hope I haven't wasted my money or my time.
Oh, my God.
And who can blame you for having that reaction? Then it can be self-fulfilling.
Yeah, like when I went, and I'm not naming names, but you can read my review of Take Me Home Tonight, the 1980s look back at the valley by Topher Grace, which this was his step out of the gate with his own production company. My God,
well,
horrible.
I would say more to the point might be Tower Heist, because we had this discussion on the show a couple weeks ago where you actually said, yeah, no, it's not a bad movie, even though you had talked about how much you hated it when you saw it, because your expectation was that the movie was going to be funny.
Right.
And it was not.
No.
I was struck because, of course, I had heard you hate it and how it wasn't funny. I came away from that with the expectation that it wasn't any good.
Right.
And it's not that it was bad. It's just that it isn't what you expected, and it certainly isn't what they led you to believe that you were to expect. But
right.
as a caper movie, it actually works.
It actually works.
It's well constructed, and there's some good set pieces in it.
Absolutely. But as they made the trailer for it, they sort of jammed all the jokes. All the jokes, mind you.
Yeah.
And whoever cut the trailer had a way better sense of comedy timing than whoever actually
and
cut the
degree,
movie.
And to a degree, if you're putting in... Ben Stiller, teaming up Ben Stiller with
Eddie Murphy.
With Eddie Murphy.
You would think.
From the director of the Rush Hour movies, you're sending a message. Right. Especially if that's how you market it.
Right, exactly. So.
Okay, so that's your caveat. My caveat is just a film, and it's...
just a film?
I was unable to see The Interrupters, which is the one documentary on the Metacritic top 32 films, the consensus best 32 films of the year. According to critics, it was the one documentary that made the list. It's on Josh Glasgow's list at Glasgow to the Movies, and it's a film that could not be more up my alley, of course, because this is the film about former gang members turned violence prevention specialists in the inner city, which describes my personal journey. To a T.
You are gangster, if nothing.
Former gangster.
Reformed
gangster.
Gangsta. That's how you pronounce it. I forgot.
I am, after all, the Podfather.
I know. And the amount of laser tattoo removal you've had done has altered your looks forever.
Just while we've sat here.
Yes.
So I'm going to guess that you don't have any honorable mentions on your list.
No, but I have three tied for ninth, but I'm going to now switch that up. And because, you know, I'm not a fan of probably what's on your list.
Well, why don't I start, by virtue of not having seen them?
Okay.
You're not a fan? Why don't I start with one of my honorable mention, and you can decide which one is on yours.
Number nine, yeah. Okay, good.
One of the number nines. Number nine.
Number nine.
I mentioned one of these films last week, and it certainly is a very interesting film. And you know, this is the problem with seeing so many great films over the last 10 days.
You don't know how
much they can resonate, and you don't want to go overboard. You know, you want to see how they hold up, you know, over a matter of days, weeks, months, and what you want to rewatch. And this film was certified copy, and I mentioned it.
Oh, yeah, right. That sounded like really good.
The great Iranian director Abbas Kiarostami, who did one of the most important films of the 1990s, Close Up. It starred Juliette Binoche and opera singer William Schimmel.
Of course.
And it is this wonderful film that starts off as a treatise about art and how we value the original, but maybe we should reappraise how we look at the original versus the forgery.
Right.
You know, the idea of an original copy. And it focuses on this relationship in the first half of the film by these two strangers who come together at this art symposium and then spend the day together. And then as they're telling a story midway through the film, then from that point on, they're a married couple talking about why their marriage has fallen into collapse. And so you're left wondering, well, which one's the real story? Which one's the copy? And does it matter?
And does it matter?
And
is
so,
not both stories valid? And does not each one resonate unto itself? So good.
It's a character driven, relationship, version of Alan Rene's Last Year at Marion Bad. I mean, that's the way I describe it.
That's awesome. Well, you know, as a painter, I'm painting a lot of 16th and 15th century paintings and putting in pop culture icons into them. And so this aspect of copying resonates very deeply for me in my painting work. And I think this is something I should see.
Another on my honorable mention list that I saw last night.
Oh my gosh.
Got back late at night and went and saw it. Cinefamily, silent movie theater. Part of a one-week run, a film that was never supposed to get released to Los Angeles, and we've talked about it on previous shows, Margaret.
Oh, yeah.
The second film from Oscar-nominated director Kenneth Lonergan. All you need to know about really the tortured history of this film is to know it was shot in 2005. The first time you see Matt Damon on screen, you go, wow, he looked young. The copyright on the film is 2008.
Wow.
It was released into one theater to fulfill their theatrical requirement in 2011, and it's only coming to LA, and I'm seeing it now in 2012, four years after the copyright. I've talked before in previous shows about the battle over the cut, and that's what apparently got so personal, because otherwise, why would you just... As a company,
you just walk away.
Yeah, why would you bury it? Why wouldn't you try to make some money off of it? You sunk the money into it. But no, it just clearly it became personal. And also, I think what hurt the film in terms of being allowed to try to make friends around the world is that two of the three producers of it, Anthony Minghella and Sidney Pollack, have died since the film was shot. And you got to believe if those two gentlemen were still alive, it might have ended up having a different life today. The director delivered a 3-hour cut of the film. The studio wanted a 2-hour cut of the film. Ultimately, the film that's been released is Martin Scorsese and Thelma Schoonmaker's 2.5-hour compromise.
Right.
And compromise is the word because what is compromised at times throughout it is any sense of cuts making sense.
Oh, no, really?
You know, you're very aware of a chunk is missing, a jump cut. And sometimes those are exciting.
Right.
Where you discover something. But there is this sense that pieces are missing, that explanations for things are not what you think they are because pieces are missing. So there's this sense that you aren't... I mean, you're aware kind of during it that you're not getting the full picture. And then there are sequences in it that linger so long that seem almost inexplicable and don't seem to add anything. And on the one hand, you go, well, why couldn't that be cut out? But on the other hand, maybe if more had been put back in, that would have been
relevant. Held it relevant.
And so I imagine it's what original fans of cinema and Orson Welles felt when they saw the butchered Magnificent Ambersons.
Yeah.
Not to that degree, but I kept hoping, thinking, I can't wait to rewatch it if a director's cut is ever released. I've heard a rumor of a Blu-ray in 2016.
If they didn't go to Pacific Disc.
Because there is so much greatness in it. And and Anna Paquin, who was very close to the age she was playing of 17 back when she shot it, is truly extraordinary. And many of the actors are. There's greatness in it. But I can't say that the finished piece is one of my top 10.
That's so sad.
So have you decided what your honorable mention is?
Well, yeah. It's going to be Descendants. George Clooney's Descendants.
It's not George Clooney's Descendants. Well, it's Alexander Payne's Descendants.
I know, but everybody's like saying that George Clooney's carrying that thing. And I didn't think it was very good in this at all. And I'm sorry. I'm bucking the trend in terms of all the award nominations this thing is getting. But I reconsidered some of your comments that this is one of the first films set in Hawaii in modern day.
Well, really using it as a character authentically.
Yes. Authentically, as people who live in Hawaii. Yeah.
Rather than how we like to think of it.
Right, as opposed to the Brady Bunch version of surfing and having
the tiki. Or just the film version of it.
Right.
Right,
exactly. So I give that an honorable mention only because of your chat on the Descendants.
But don't you also think, I mean, there is much honorable in it. That's the word.
That's
you know,
the thing.
Honorable.
Yes. She, the young actress, is so fantastic in it.
And what gets visited upon these kids and how that's depicted seems quite honorable indeed.
Yes.
I thought that also honorable was the way they kind of show, you know, the patterning that goes through the generations. I mean, when you realize that as much as Clooney and his father-in-law hate each other, they both married the same woman.
Yeah.
I mean, they're both brain dead.
Brain dead women. Yeah, that's interesting.
And getting back to the father-in-law, Robert Forster, here's an actor we recognize.
Right.
And yet who totally inhabits that character.
Looks so different. Barely recognized him.
And that's what I craved from the casting of the main character.
Yeah. See, that's
I understand you need to have someone recognizable doing it, but I love the poster. Did you see that website that showed the movie posters of the most nominated films as it? But if there was a law requiring you to actually advertise the movie as it was?
No, I have not seen that.
And the poster for The Descendants is something along the lines, they changed the titles of all these movies.
Yeah.
And the poster for The Descendants is, look at George Clooney. Isn't he good at acting?
That's exactly it. I mean,
you're aware the whole time you're looking at George Clooney.
Not just looking at George Clooney, looking at his eyeliner, looking at his hair, like the
and comparing and this to everything he's done before.
Absolutely.
Oh, I've never seen George Clooney do that before.
Right, or I've seen him do better.
And it is such a subtle trick because you do want to see an actor do something that they haven't done before.
Yes.
But if you're aware of that during it, it means it's not working.
Right. And it's taking you out.
If you're saying, oh, isn't he great in this?
Right.
You're not believing it on some level.
Right. You're stopping. You're not even in the film at that point. Going, wow, look at how good that thing is over there.
And of course, even for Alexander Payne, this movie doesn't get made without an A-list star playing that. And that's really one of the most sad things about this.
Right.
Alexander's next film... that he wants to make. You know, here's multiple Oscar nominee. He's an Oscar winner,
Sideways.
Alexander Payne. His movies make money.
Yes, they do.
His next movie he wants to make is a $10 million black and white film.
Seems
that's not expensive.
Right.
I would think a $10 million black and white film from Alexander Payne is pretty much guaranteed to make money.
Right.
At this point.
You're going to make that money back.
His reputation.
Right.
And
he can't find a studio.
Unless he agrees to use one of the following actors. Jack Nicholson... Right, with whom he's worked before, getting Gene Hackman out of retirement to do it. I mean, it's really
interesting.
As opposed to, say, using a guy like Robert Forster, who is of their age group and might be, and I haven't read it, I don't know, but could be
exactly what they're looking for. Exactly.
Like a Richard Jenkins in The Visitor.
Another excellent point.
Going back to my beloved David Lynch, is Straight Story, though, which was the one film that was... The least Lynch-like, the family film he did. And of course getting, who was that old wonderful stuntman turned actor that
I can't remember his name. IMDb, here we come.
Anyway, but you know, using someone who just is the part for that.
Yeah, it's true. Well, sad but true.
Anyway. So that's your honorable mention.
Yeah.
My final honorable mention, also something I finally caught up to this week, and need to discuss because shame on me, really, for not wanting to see this.
There is a lot of shame on you.
It's Lars von Trier's Melancholia.
Oh, yeah. Why didn't you want to see that?
I am not a Lars von Trier fan. Do you remember a few weeks ago I talked about Tilda Swinton?
Yes.
And how this is someone who I admire, and yet she just bugs me. There's something about her that bugs me all the time.
Right.
I feel the same way about R.E.M. I admire them without liking them, and they kind of bug me. Personal taste. We're allowed to personal taste.
And I got
to
say, I could see a similarity between Michael Stipe and Tilda Swinton.
And Phil Lernis.
Yeah, you all look alike.
Who gets mistaken for both of them quite often.
That's why you...
Aren't you the queen in
Queen Victoria?
Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
Yes. Yeah,
Don't enjoy Lars von Trier's movies, generally. Right. And, of course, as you know, I'm a big Dogma fan.
Yes, you
are. And Lars von Trier is one of the founding figures of Dogma.
The Dogma movement.
There's just something about his films that leave me cold. And so I had no interest. I'm not a Kirsten Dunst fan.
Right.
I wasn't interested, and every chance I had to see this film theatrically...
You skipped it.
I skipped it.
Right.
And then I find out... It's a science fiction film.
I know. How did that marketing not get out?
It's a science fiction film about a discovered planet that is hurtling towards Earth. Interesting that we had two films about this, about another planet coming towards Earth. Another Earth this year.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And it's hurtling towards Earth on a collision course. Lars von Trier tells a story not of how globally we are confronting this, or what this will, what the options are, or how we are facing our final days. Instead, he tells the story about how a woman's depression is affecting her wedding ceremony.
As a planet hurtling.
This movie is 2001 meets Rachel Getting Married.
I thought you were going to say Armageddon.
And it is, again, in my honorable mention list.
Right.
Not one of my 10 favorites. I wouldn't even say necessarily at this point one of the 10 best, though maybe someday I will. But again, I've seen it so recently.
Have you seen it?
I saw it 2 days ago.
Oh, yeah.
And I wouldn't be actually having a film on my honorable mention list without seeing it, Dean Haglund.
Really? No, this year, everything, more or less.
But it is, you know that I love when films have rich metaphor.
Right.
And maybe even, God willing, a little allegory going on.
Imagine I love a little that. Allegory.
And this is a film that uses this this collision between planets, between bodies, is a metaphor for the collision between the two worlds in which two sisters live, and how when those worlds truly do collide, there can be no living in either of those worlds from that point forward.
Wow.
The film can only be understood metaphorically because it is about their lives. It's broken up into two halves with two chapter headings, part one and part two. And so that's the metaphor. And of course, the allegory is about this world that we all sense is coming towards us in our modern age, that a new world
is hurtling,
approaching in 2012 as life speeds more forward. There is a new world, and that those who think that they should be allowed to keep living in this world might just be facing destruction.
Right. That don't want to embrace the change.
Or those people who think that it's all about living in the other world that's coming might just face destruction as well. That maybe it's about what gets born out of the scintillating collision between those worlds.
Wow. Now, see, how come that movie wasn't marketed like that? As opposed to just, it's melancholy, it's dour.
Well, this is why I feel a Chilpak Hollywood Hour movie lover's companion is a good idea, because it's not about us reviewing movies. It's about us talking, and it's not even, and I don't even think we should bother, famous last words.
Yeah.
But with movies we don't like, there's no panning. It's about talking about movies in such a way that, hey, this is not going to be everyone's cup of tea.
Right.
But this might give you more of an interest in something that you never got to know about because it wasn't marketed to you.
See, we talk about marketing a lot. Maybe the blog should be sort of a kind of a film lover's companion where we strip away the marketing.
Yeah.
We strip away the idiotic marketing.
Or at least push against it.
Yes.
To say, look, don't let this give you the wrong idea.
So it's the ill-marketed movie of the week. Huh?
I wish I could remember what the helps poster was on that website that gave Truth in Advertising.
Oh, yeah.
But I know the ad line for it was, "You're welcome, black people." It's something about, you know, what I said when the movie came out about, again, it's about honorable white people saving black people.
Yeah, and shit pies. But yeah, it's more or less it.
Anyway, so Melancholia, my final honorable mention.
Fantastic.
Boy, we're halfway through today's show and we haven't gotten to the top 10.
Okay, me? So number 10 would be Captain America. Oh, that was a good one. Everybody was worried and then it came. What? How come you didn't like Captain America? It's number 10. These are movies I saw.
10 films Dean Haglund has seen. Look, I'm glad you have a 10. I said on this show about the fact that I liked the first half. I thought the period depictions and details were
great,
fantastic, and all of that. And it wasn't until the
Red Skull,
the action film started, and the fact that Red Skull is the spoiler alert, the surprise villain in the new Avengers movie really bothers me.
Why did you not? You didn't have to spoil that.
I don't know. That's only the only reason we believe that is because that was one of the toys that's been released for the new Avengers.
Oh, right.
Thing. Yeah.
Well, he can be killed off early.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, well.
That's okay, my number 10. So Captain America, number 10. My number 10 might be surprising for most people. Certainly, if you had gone into the year, it would have been surprising. And when I compile my top 10 list, and when we do write about these things through Chilpak Hollywood Hours Movie Lover's Companion, you know, it's to try to take from the perspective of those films that do get traction at the box office, and what does that say about audiences, and what can we learn from that? What can we learn from critics and how they're writing about films and what they gravitate towards, and from filmmakers themselves. What movies are they being drawn to make?
Right.
What stories are interesting them, and how are they going about telling them? If we could combine these things, then we could create a different conversation where almost exclusively, it seems, you get to engage in one of those conversations.
Right.
And not in any of them. So my list tries again to be diverse in that way. And number 10... Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh!
Director Rupert Wyatt manages to pull off a trick of both rebooting a franchise and doing a sequel to it at the same time, because it is a sequel to the Mark Wahlberg Planet, or it's a prequel to the Mark Wahlberg Planet.
Right.
Or is it yes, because they certain events that you learn about in the Mark Wahlberg Planet of the Apes, you hear about during this Rise of the Planet of the Apes. It's everything that... I want from a big
budget
blockbuster
movie,
film.
It's told from the perspective of the monkey.
Yeah, an interesting perspective.
Right.
Know?
And where they tried to
get... And that monkey's a great actor.
And that's Andy Serkis, yeah. Who, did you see the cover of Variety where they had the 3D lenticular cover to try to get him an Oscar nomination?
I didn't.
No, it was a full... I don't know how much it cost. Like, lenticular 3D is the one where if you twist it sideways, it turns from one image to the other. So it was Andy's face in the full body makeup with the camera and the light in his eye, how they do motion capture face work now. And then it switches over to the actual... animated monkey in the... Is he a monkey or an ape? I guess he's an ape. And the animated ape that showed up in the movie, and they were going for your consideration, trying to get him an Oscar in this
to get you to look at things a different way.
Right, because even James Franco did a whole thing going, yes, he was. I was definitely acting with Andy.
This movie does make you look at things a different way without being heavy-handed about that. I mean, to, you know, in the best sense of science fiction, going back to the original wonderful Planet of the Apes based on the Pierre Boulle novel,
right,
written by Rod Serling, you know, making you think about contemporary issues,
right, as every good science fiction does.
In a different way,
right,
and in this film, of course, pharmaceuticals and
testing and all that, yes,
animal testing and just such a riveting conclusion that has you so eager for the next one, and Rupert Wyatt is on board to helm the next one. And as we've talked about before, you can go overboard with these reboots, loving them, and to a certain degree, the proof is as to how good it was is in terms of where it leads.
Right.
But you've got to like the chances, given that he's going to be behind the next one. Too.
There you go.
Number 10. Number 9 for you.
Number 9, Sherlock Holmes. With Robert Downey Jr. Now, I know you're not a fan because you're watching the BBC Sherlock Holmes.
Well, also, you had the first one on your top 10 list.
I had the first one.
Yeah, you had the first one on your top 10 list that year, and I didn't. And and I didn't because of the third act being bad.
Bad.
But I would take that third act over any of the acts in this one, which played like a parody of the first one.
I disagree. I thought there was much
more... Didn't it seem like they had half the budget of the first one?
Well, no. I thought the digital work was a lot more... And it's also about World War One arms manufacturing. There's a lot of history. The car shows up. I mean, to me, it's almost proto steampunk. Which you're all about steampunk, which is why I can't believe you didn't like it more. So anyway, that's mine.
I have a little bit of a problem with any film that cuts from a man on a meat hook being tortured on a meat hook to Stephen Fry walking around naked.
Was that the cut?
Yeah, from torture. To absolute torture.
Well, the books were strategically placed. Spoiler alert.
I was just talking about in the theater. Stephen Fry was
just walking around naked.
Number 9 on my list. Much like these films we've been talking about, a crowd pleasing blockbuster.
Yep.
The capper to the Harry Potter series.
Harry
Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, not making anyone's top 10 list.
Nope.
Got pushed hard for Best Picture.
Yep.
It was an uphill battle because, let's face it, some of the Harry Potter films, as pleasing as they might have been, were certainly not approaching the level of classic or any of these things.
Thank you, Christopher Columbus.
Both as a capper to the series, it's quite an achievement.
Uh-huh.
But also as a film itself.
Standalone.
As a film itself, it is... It is powerful. It is exciting. It is almost Shakespearean.
Now, did you read
and operatic in its drama?
And you were desperately reading all the Harry Potter.
I read all the books.
Yeah. So you already had,
and I already knew what was going to happen. And again, maybe that's a really good point. This is something that I feel elevated the book.
Right.
Sometimes that didn't happen. Sometimes it did. As we know, the Harry Potter films are no different than you know any book adaptation. Sometimes the best books don't lend themselves to the best adaptations.
Right.
And it's sometimes the flawed books
That do better. Yeah. Because there's corrections that can be made cinematically, particularly if the writer's trying to write cinematically.
Goblet of Fire was a very good movie by Mike Newell, but not a great movie, even though that was the best book of the bunch.
Right.
But it was the most wide-sweeping and epic book of the bunch. Up until Harry Potter 7, the one other truly great cinematic achievement in the series was the third one, Prisoner of Azkaban, by Cuarón, the great director Cuarón.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a great book.
Right.
It was slight compared to Goblet of Fire.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, there you go.
So number eight for you.
Number eight. Oh, The Adventures of Tintin. The anime.
You saw it.
I did see it. And I loved it. Well, I didn't. Well, here's the thing. Did
you
I
are
love
a
it?
Fan of Tintin.
I am a fan. I have his action figures. I have the books. I even have him. Tintin goes to space in the little spacesuit, in the snowy spacesuit. But here's the thing. The technology of the motion capture, and Andy, of course, is in this one, too, playing Captain Haddock. And that's probably why I didn't get an animation Oscar nomination, because they were hunting for him to get a live-action acting nomination. So if he's in that one, how can we call that animation if we're calling the
Would you call it animation?
It's right on the cusp, because it's not a frame by frame thought. You're actually capturing motion, and then you're putting in these set designs which look identical to all the big budget set designs now, right?
I mean, right, with the lens flare. Including lens flare.
I know, the whole thing, like all of those preloaded program clicks that they have now. And the problem with Tintin that I love was that here was this simple guy going on these crazy adventures drawn simply. It was a simple, simple line drawing, right? So that innocence, that purity then counterpointed the action. But when you suddenly made it this high technical digital revolution, it sort of lost that innocence, even though he was saying, you know, great snakes and yikes and all of those catchphrases that he was known for in the comic book. When he said them, and it was coming from a digital motion capture animated thingy, it sort of lost that original Tintin joyous innocence. So that's why it sits at number eight.
I can't wait to see it. Yeah. My number eight. Now, will I enjoy it as someone who has no knowledge of Tintin?
Yes. In fact, you might enjoy it more.
Okay. Yeah. Because, of course, again, how these things are marketed.
Yes.
It was pushed very hard around the world where they love Tintin, and they made a huge amount of money there.
Yeah.
It was even released into Canada first.
Yeah.
Because I guess in Canada...
You had it in popular. The libraries, yes.
Yeah. And then in the U.S., not really a huge marketing push behind it because they don't know it.
Right.
So therefore, they won't like it.
Right.
As opposed to not knowing something might mean you like it more.
Exactly.
Who cares?
We've
already made our money.
Right. Where's Tintin sell the most? We got to go into those markets. Yeah.
So we got to preach to the choir.
Yeah.
In the form of lots and lots of money. My number eight from director Almodovar.
Right.
Yes. Pedro Almodovar. And I mentioned him and the trick he pulls off with the skin I live in.
Yeah.
In this film. You know, it is amazing. It occurred to me, and this is true of all his films, that at least the ones that really work, he pulls off an unbelievable trick where you walk into them, and even if you didn't know what you were going to see or who made it, within a few minutes, you know who the director of that film is.
Right.
It's the signature is that clear.
That's fingerprint.
At the same time, you have no idea where the thing is going.
Which is
it
part of his whole thing.
It will constantly surprise you.
Yeah.
How something can be both so recognizable and surprising at the same time, and how that the director can pull that trick off time and time again is extraordinary. This film, The Skin I Live In, almost plays like a parody of some of his earlier films, while at the same time shocking you and disturbing you and making you laugh, which shocks you and disturbs you all the more, and
wow.
being sexy and then making you uncomfortable about what you find sexy. I love that a director of his ilk, of his accomplishment, of his fame, unlike his peers in America, who I would count as people like Scorsese, Spielberg, yeah. Woody Allen, he actually still makes movies intentionally to try to put you on edge, to try to make you uncomfortable.
Oh, interesting.
To try, you know, when I saw it, a third of the people or more in that theater hated it.
Oh, really?
And I know Pedro Almodovar would have loved that. Because he's still, you can tell in his films, still filled with the same passion that drew him to making movies in the first place.
Well, that's great.
This film in particular, The Skin I Live In, is science fiction as well. Oh. As well as kind of hostage drama and thriller and crime film and murder mystery. Without giving anything away, it basically focuses on a scientist played by Antonio Banderas, who has one of his most interesting roles. And I had almost forgotten how much fun he is to watch.
Oh, yeah.
When he's not animated as an overweight cat.
And he's in Puss in
Boots. Different stories. Two different stories. One where he is experimenting on trying to create a skin for human beings that cannot burn because he lost someone dear to him in a fire.
Wow.
And he's experimenting, grafting this skin onto a beautiful woman, Elena Anaya, a world-class beauty and a great actress, putting the skin on her. What you begin to become aware of is that she might not be undergoing these experiments of her own free will. What are the circumstances? We don't know. At the same time, through flashback, we're told a story about how Antonio Banderas' daughter was raped. At least he believes he's raped. We're led to believe she's raped. And she goes insane. And as a response to this and the lack of justice, he goes, he finds the person who did it. He kidnaps him, holds him hostage, and tortures him.
Holy.
And these are the two stories that are kind of weaved back and forth until they cross.
Wow.
In delightful ways.
And there's laughs in this, you say. That's hard to believe.
If only because of the audacity of it.
Ah, see?
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty good.
Okay, so number seven for you.
Number seven, I have, X-Men, First Class. That's the bringing together.
That's a very good one.
Yeah, that's a Fassbinder and as Magneto. And how great is it that they put in the whole Cold War aspect in there, 1962 and the Bay of Pigs, as part of their whole coming together and splitting apart. It was very well done. And I don't remember ever reading the X-Men origin comic book, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't the Bay of Pigs crisis. So
you know, this made Quentin Tarantino's top 10 films.
No, I did not know.
The year. Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm glad he enjoyed it.
It really is, and quite a triumph also for Matthew Vaughn, the director, who you know I loved because of Layer Cake and was incredibly disappointed in because of Kick-Ass.
Kick-Ass, yeah, which I sort of liked.
Yeah, well, for me, again, the thing with that was I thought that the first half worked, but I couldn't see Matthew Vaughn in it.
Right.
And then in the second half, I saw him imposing his personality on it, and I thought it didn't work as well.
Right.
And this time, he really, it's his personality.
Right.
Anyway, it is a triumph. Number seven for me, from one of your favorite filmmakers, I almost call him Doctor. Tomas Alfredson.
Oh, yeah.
From Tomas Alfredson, the director of Let the Right One In.
Yes.
Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
I still haven't seen it.
I loved the miniseries, of course. Alec Guinness as George Smiley. I'm so glad that Gary Oldman got an Oscar nomination for a fantastic transformation, a fantastic performance, but also in some ways a thankless performance because he does what all actors know is great acting. He listens. His whole character is about listening.
Yeah.
Not about doing or going and finding. Listening and observing. That's the performance. And how do you make that kind of performance riveting? Gary Oldman does it. This director, for all the excitement and the thrills of Let the Right One In, that was such a wonderful character piece. It was so emotionally haunting and affecting. And it was one of the best coming-of-age stories I'd ever seen.
Absolutely.
And Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, the heart of it, the emotions in it, are what really, really carry the film. And it is such a quiet film. And it's fascinating to me how many people see it and go, well, it just was so confusing. It was so confusing. Lily saw it with me, and I was curious because I've read the books. I've seen the original miniseries. I knew what was going to happen.
Right.
Yes, there were changes, but I knew.
More or less.
I was curious with someone who had no familiarity with it and someone who, when she sees spy thrillers, tends to get somewhat confused in them. She walked out going, how could anyone be confused by this? It is so easy. They tell you what's going on. All you have to do is listen. And in fact, what I realized is the reason she gets confused in most spy thrillers is the same reason why so many people are finding this film confusing. And that is, she tends to get bored by action.
Ah.
And she loses the plot.
Right.
Most people want a break.
From listening.
Yeah.
And want some
quiet
action.
Quiet especially bothers people.
Oh, right.
Quiet films bother people.
Ah, so this is a quiet.
Silence. We need, and yet, what could be better for an actual Cold War suspense thriller?
Thriller than that. Blah. Okay.
It's nice to think that it all was James Bond adventures, but for the most part, it was civil servants
hanging
who were
sitting
and listening and watching.
Yeah.
And trying to make sense of things.
Isn't that something?
And the best cast of the year, and including my man crush, Benedict Cumberbatch, as Peter Gwillem, and my old friend Tom Hardy.
Tom Hardy.
Who's fantastic.
Now, Tom Hardy was in what film that you did? How did you know Tom Hardy?
Well, we were talking about doing Illumination.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Number six. Mine's Bridesmaids.
I don't even think that you liked that.
I did like that.
Oh.
I thought it was funny. And I thought there was a movie that proves that women are funny. And what about, other than, yes, they still find the man at the end. That's the bit of the letdown. That's why it sits down there. But they did fight the studio executives that thought we need a male lead in this script. And it was Judd Apatow who said, hey, man, we let these chicks run it themselves, and that's the thing. And he made a wall between him and the executives, which is exactly like Matt Groening did on The Simpsons, and let that movie shine.
See, for me, I think, again, it gets back to expectations. I never needed to be proven that women were funny.
Right.
I actually think women are funnier than men.
Yes.
And, or else, why would they be with us?
Ah.
And they certainly have better senses of humor.
Yes.
And showing that they could behave like the men in The Hangover.
Well, yeah, they did, but they didn't. There was also an emotional core, and there was something. There was a lot of things that The Hangover didn't have. And yes, they shit in a sink. Spoiler alert. But
hey, it's it was number 15 or 16 on the Metacritic's consensus, the film critics' consensus of the best films of the year.
Well, there you go.
So you are not alone, sir.
There you go.
I'm very much in the minority. my number six, we've talked about it. You love it as well. I'm imagining it'll end up higher on your list. Described as on that site that Truth in Advertising about what the films should be called, Brad Pitt talking about sport, Moneyball, which is such a wonderful and fun film from director Bennett Miller, who was such a great choice to replace Steven Soderbergh, the director and writer of Capote.
Yeah.
For a couple of reasons. One, he's so good at making workplace procedures interesting.
Yeah.
He does that in Capote. He does that in Moneyball. And this is a film that don't let the baseball element of it scare you in any way.
You don't even...
This is about innovation in business.
Yeah.
And how someone who wants to innovate the way business is done, change the way, the outmoded way business is done, and what could be more relevant in our contemporary society, this is about how those people who innovate the way business is done fight to get those innovations that will help everybody get those
And it's always the pioneer who gets shot in the back.
Another way that that Bennett Miller was such a great choice, I remember the trick he pulled off in Capote, how often Truman Capote spent time on the phone calling his lover, calling his friends, publishers, all of this. So many of the key scenes in that movie were on the phone, which you're taught in screenwriting, keep characters off the phone. It's the death to drama.
Right.
How much does Brad Pitt spend on the phone, on the cell phone to his daughter, texting, making calls, doing the trades, doing all this? You really got the sense that this character's life is spent on the phone.
Yeah.
And thanks to the director and thanks to the perfect movie star performance by Brad Pitt. It is all riveting. It's riveting in the same way as Robert Redford and All the President's Men making those phone calls as he's doing the legwork on the phone is riveting.
And the only problem I have with this movie is that all of the characters' big emotional moments are completely in the dark or out of focus. Take a look at that film again, and you'll see that he is either backlit, not lit. He's on a video screen.
Interesting.
Any of the big emotions, so where he's doing the business and stuff like that, he is under full fluorescent lights. He's getting the big close-up. But when it comes to like his moments of self-doubt or fighting the system, all of those emotional angst things are blacked out almost. And I could see it from a production design point of view that these are his darkest moments. But I think that probably will rob him of a lot more awards had they actually given that full light and the full close-up.
Wow, we are definitely going over time on today's show, and that's well, fine. Yeah, I mean, okay. It's once a year we do this. Well, so, yeah. So your top five.
Number five is Midnight in Paris, Woody Allen's thing. His thing that brought him back. It's like, it's one it looks like he actually did a rewrite on. Some of his earlier stuff, you know, I did a voiceover doing an anime thing in New York. When I was in New York doing stand-up, I had to go into the studio, and it was the studio that Woody Allen uses to do all this post-production. So it was a big honor, and we're talking Woody Allen. And the guy said, yeah, you know, Woody Allen sort of writes 4 hours a day longhand, but then he just hands it to a secretary, and she has to make sense of it and put it into a screenplay.
Right.
And this was like why a lot of those movies, Happy Ending and the Jade Scorpion and all of those sort of things, just seemed disjointed.
There was a lot of effort put into Midnight in Paris.
Effort, yes. That suddenly he started with the title and then he was inspired. Inspired by the great writers. Obviously, he thought about writing again. Something inspired him and made this movie have a little effort behind it.
I think one of the inspired elements is the casting of Owen Wilson. And as right. I said this summer, no leading man and director more needed each other than the two of them.
It's true.
To become relevant again. Owen Wilson is still Owen Wilson.
Yeah.
He's one of the only leading men to not try to do a Woody Allen. And
because he already sounds like a Woody Allen.
And so he has this kind of fresh, authentic charm about him that Woody Allen and Woody Allen's clones don't have. And
true.
That really helps breathe life into this. And it's good writing that tends to offset some of maybe Owen Wilson's more lazy tendencies as an actor.
Yes.
The other thing that is really interesting about it is this idea of making a film where the theme is be careful about pining for the Belle Epoque, for the golden age, for the wonderful days of the past that you wish. You know, I was born in the wrong era.
Yeah.
Be careful of those things because they're not true.
Yes.
They're not true.
They are.
And this is really one of those cases of I would never have believed you if you told me that Woody Allen was going to make that movie, because who more
sentimentalizes
to
live
buy
in the past.
Into that yes. illusion? But again, who better to make this film then? Because
he has butted.
Only Nixon can go to China.
That's right.
Right?
Right, which is the other, it should be the subtitle of this.
Only Woody can go to
exactly.
the Belle Epoque.
Yep.
My number five, and a film that had it not made my top 10 list, definitely would have been one of the most overlooked films of 2011, from director Jeff Nichols, his second film. His first was The Extraordinary Shotgun Stories. His second, reuniting him with his leading man from Shotgun Stories, the amazing Michael Shannon, Take Shelter.
Oh,
and this
yeah.
is about a man who fears that he is succumbing to a mental illness that has been a family legacy, and who also fears that a giant storm is coming to wipe us all away. And it is one of the hardest films to watch. I actually had to excuse myself a couple times during the movie because its depiction of a man descending and fighting that descent into madness is so authentic. Too painful.
Right. But a payoff.
But the whole movie is so redeemed by a payoff that is exhilarating for the audience. It makes everything you went through as an audience so joyously worthwhile.
Nah.
And it's an extraordinary achievement. And again, as I've said about Michael Shannon's performance and Vanessa Redgrave's performance in Coriolanus, on the blog about the overlooked films, why Screen Actors Guild even bother having awards if you're not going to nominate performances like these?
Yeah. And bounce my check, by the way, Screen Actors Guild. Well, how could you do a lavish production of Screen Actors Awards and still bounce my residual check?
We are going to have some serious Screen Actors Guild business to talk about next week.
Yes, we are.
Especially with now both the boards of AFTRA and SAG
merging,
massively approving the merger, and now it going to a vote from both membership bodies.
So, how about that?
But that'll be perhaps next week.
Right.
When now we're still on. Discussing our top 10.
Yes.
Number four for you on
number
the top
four,
10.
Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
You saw it.
I saw it down the weekend. That was the one. And I disagreed with you. I thought it actually, you said the first hour was action-packed, that everything, and then the second hour fell apart for you.
No, I didn't say that. I said it couldn't live up to how good the first 75 minutes were, where everything was perfect.
Yeah. Well, to me, that was a great setup. And then I thought the end had to pay off. I mean, it had to have a big action sequence.
No, they just started to make some missteps, and it just wasn't up to enough. I mean, that's what we've talked. It's the closest to a great movie that the series has produced thus far.
Right.
And the first 75 minutes, I was going, oh, this is going to be on my top 10 list. And then when they started making missteps and missing opportunities that would have been really rewarding.
Like?
Well, the introduction of an arms dealer in the third act as a deus ex machina is sloppy, whereas you'd already introduced an arms dealer that could have fulfilled that role in the very first
scene. Yeah, I thought
no,
that
in the very first Mission Impossible. The whole time that he's on the phone in the train at the beginning of Mission Impossible 4 when he's going, is he going to be there? Tell me he's going to be there.
Oh, yeah.
Make sure that he's going to be there. And then I want to meet this arms dealer. And then when he goes to meet the arms dealer, he's a blindfold is put on him by an arms dealer's henchman.
Right.
Well, that henchman was in the first Mission Impossible movie as an arms dealer henchman. And when he was demanding to see him, the arms dealer, Max, played by Vanessa Redgrave.
Uh-huh.
And that's the big turning point in the first one.
That's right.
And to bring her back in the fourth one would have been a
brilliant thing.
Would have been brilliant, especially because it would have sent the message that even though she gets, quote unquote, arrested at the end of the first one, these arms dealers are constantly set loose again because the government that's got them can now use them.
Right.
Which is the theme of Mission Impossible 4. So it was just things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was very much the best of the series and you know, probably the best action film of the year.
Absolutely.
But so I didn't say that the first half was great and the second half wasn't great.
That's what I heard.
That's not what I
awesome.
Said at all.
Fantastic. But yeah, you're right. If Vanessa Redgrave was in that, I would have like shit my pants.
You know, it's just everything. I didn't even look at my watch.
Yeah.
For the first like 75 minutes. And then there were some scenes where going, okay, now they're working really hard to set things up again.
Right.
And then it'll be exciting, and now we got to set it up again. It just, the momentum didn't maintain it.
And a couple of product placements. And
Wait till you see the car, exactly.
I know, right? Oh, dear.
All right, so my number four, also action-packed wall-to-wall with whiz-bang excitement, Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life.
Oh, yeah. Still haven't got to that.
You know, this is, again, another science fiction film.
Yep.
And
is it science fiction?
Yeah, it very much... yeah, I mean, this is very much 2001, and you know, the idea that Kubrick had of the mysteries of the universe being solved in a hotel room. And this is about the mysteries of the human heart and about pain and loss as told through the entire history of the planet Earth. And it's, you know, I could go on and on with what the overwhelming praise for the film has been. I could go on and on with what people don't like about it. Again, it's silent. It's slow. I hate when people say, well, it's so pretentious and pompous. I mean, this artist, Terrence Malick, was driven to try to make sense of the death of his own brother.
Right.
From when they were boys. That's autobiographical about that death and about the path that he took to gain acceptance.
Right.
Is that pretentious?
Yeah, really?
Is that to take your healing and to try to share it? And
use it in your creative form that you've chosen as a career? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but I would like to say just two stories about the greatness of this film. One is afterwards, knowing in an audience that was sold out that many people did not dig it. During the movie, being aware that many people were not digging it, and yet everyone remaining so quiet throughout it. as if they were in a church. There was definitely this sacred aspect to it where you might go home, get on a blog, and be trashing vitriolic it. Yeah. about it. But in there, you were respectful. And that was really interesting and rare, isn't
rare,
it?
Rare, yeah.
And to back this up, I've had friends who were at a screening in Times Square in New York. Film.
Normally the noisiest place to see a movie.
Film broke. And for 15 minutes, everyone sat quietly and no one complained because they thought it was part of the movie.
That just the 15-minute black part we put in there. Wow. That's amazing.
Isn't that awesome?
That is awesome. All right. So finally, somebody got up. The film's broken.
If you've pulled that trick off.
That's pretty good.
A tip of the cap, my friend.
Yeah, exactly.
Number three.
Number three, I have The Help. And I'm not sure I want that on number three. No.
Thank you, black people. Well, you're welcome, black people.
No, but it was highly entertaining. It was told well. And I didn't read the book, but I thought the acting was spectacular. Mm-hmm. And in terms of a period piece, catching all of the nuanced moments, I thought were well done. But now I'm sort of thinking.
Yeah, I have no problem with the if you'll pardon the expression, the whitewashing of history a little bit. You know, people saying, "Oh, this is it does a disservice because it makes you think it was a lot better than it really was." You know, look, to open people to a history and to a chapter of history.
Right.
There's going to be a little bit of sanitizing involved,
right.
and the performances are the strength of the piece, and they do convey the human heartache and frustration and better than any scenes of, you know, rubbing our faces.
Right.
I mean, that becomes exploitive in a certain degree. The weakness for me is in kind of the split protagonist thing of, and it smacks of just another studio decision. We've seen these through the decades of,
right.
Well, we need the girl writing the book to be the main character.
Right. As opposed to them just telling that story.
But to try to offset that criticism, we'll have the maid narrate the beginning and the end to send the message that it's her story.
It's her story. Tell her about the time that person came to write a book. Yeah, I agree. And I'm sorry, I've eaten a lot of bad chocolate in my day, but I still think I could tell the difference. That was a...
Hello, spoiler alert.
If you don't know by now...
What number was that for you?
That was number three.
How did we skip?
Four? Mission Impossible. Five? Midnight? What
can
number?
You pause?
Okay, so now that we got our numbers right...
Yeah, my number three.
Yeah.
The Artist.
Ah!
And I, of course, have been talking about this film since before it came out, saying, mark my words, this is your Best Picture winner this year. It almost, now that it has come to pass where it's going to win Best Picture.
Absolutely.
Last night, Jean Dujardin in a huge upset win at SAG for Best Actor.
Good for him.
And good for him because it is quite a challenging role and the sort of thing that should be rewarded. Now that it is so embraced by all these awards, it almost has, to a certain degree, diminished my enjoyment of it. Because it was this kind of fun thing to go, just seen the most extraordinarily entertaining and moving and uplifting film of the year. And can you explain to me at all why this thing
hasn't been seen
can't
by everyone?
Cross over? Why is it still only at $16 million? I mean, it's really now. But you love silent film, so maybe you're the wrong person to ask. But
I am the wrong.
But it is so fun for contemporary audiences. It's so clever.
Yes,
it's so charming.
Lovely. I think so too. And for me, it's also that history of Hollywood that's told over and over again of, you know, one's demise and one's career. I think it's on my list.
It's got everything you would want. I mean, from the beauty of it to the action of it to the humor, skillful, multifaceted performances.
Right, and probably a hard sell too. What he first said, "Oh, I'm going to make a silent film."
Absolutely. I mean, he said, "I just met one insane man who decided to write a check for the whole thing, and that's how he got it made." I mean,
how could we never meet those men?
We will at some point.
All insane men, please.
And there was no prep for it at all, that the team that made the OSS movies, Michel Hazanavicius, Jean Dujardin, and Berenice Bejou, that they would then decide to do this.
I mean,
there was nothing to
indicate that was going to be.
Number three, The Artist, not a more fun film on my list.
There you go.
Year.
Awesome. My number two, Moneyball. Moneyball. Because you know what TV show I watched till the very bitter end? numbers. Why? Because it was applied mathematics and police work. And anything that has applied mathematics, even though I don't know, I don't do statistics, I'm not any movie that exemplifies math and statistics as a plot point, I support 100%. And this movie does that and does that without boring you on math details, which numbers towards the end, it's somewhere they lost their algorithms.
Right. It uses numbers in a way, again, I think, to get back to the theme we were discussing earlier, to convey and to encourage in this crazy economy, how can you take resources that maybe you're undervaluing?
Yes.
And use those to get ahead.
Right. And using statistical analysis.
You know, it's easy to say, well, we are behind everyone else because we have less of this thing that everyone else is measuring.
Right.
But what do you have more of that if you utilized correctly could get you ahead?
Right. And that was the leverage.
We talk about this with marketing all the time.
It's true. You use your strength. Your weakness is your strength. And so if you're using, and that was Oakland A's. They didn't have the money to compete against the big million, multi-million dollar teams, but they could use applied statistics to figure out who's the best player for the money. That they weren't, you know, they're not playing for the talent. They're paying for runs. And they're, you know, they.
And for 5 years, 6 years out of seven, they made the playoffs. And that's extraordinary when so few teams do, and when the payroll disparity, and as true indication of how successful they were, now the entire industry uses those applied statistical approaches that they used.
Yeah.
So now they're having to try to find a new way to
exactly
play on an uneven playing field.
And in fact, that gulf has gotten wider. I mean, now that if you're using applied mathematics and you have a $200 million budget against a $50 budget, you have now so jiggered the balance.
So you now just have to find a new blind spot. You have to. And interestingly enough, what Oakland is now doing is going back to the old ways of scouting young players that have been almost discarded by every team that they were the first to discard. They're now going back to those because now the blind spot has become the old ways of doing
right. things. Right. So they're looking for which player has the hot girlfriend to determine confidence.
Number two, for me,
yes.
Iran's entry to the Academy Awards.
Oh, yeah.
I think it also got a Best Screenplay nomination from director Asghar Farhadi. A Separation.
There you go.
This film is so good.
Is it really?
I mean, oh my God. The performances are spectacular, including a lead performance by star Payman Mawadi, who is actually a writer, not an actor. And the story is fairly simple. It's about a rather tragic incident that may or may not have occurred in an outside an apartment of a father who has separated from his wife, who is taking care of not only their daughter but his father, who has Alzheimer's.
Ah, right.
And his very career, his family life, his home, all of these things are threatened by the accusations that are leveled against him for something that may or may not have happened outside his home. And the whole movie, why is it called A Separation? Because what it rather subtly explores is all the ways we are affected when a relationship, in this case a marriage, falls apart. It's not just the two people. It's not just their kids. It's not just their parents and their friends. That ripples through entire communities.
Ah,
and
interesting.
It is, and of course, it being from Iran, it's also about spirituality versus orthodox religious beliefs.
Wow, that sounds awesome.
It's an amazing, amazing film. A Separation is number two.
Wow, and mine's The Artist. We've already talked about that. That's my number one. Of course.
Oh, that's your number one?
Yeah. So you're number one.
The Artist.
Yeah.
And my number one I spoke about a couple weeks ago. And again, I'm very much, I've become Dean Haglund.
You have.
The film that most utilizes 3D in a way that I think paves the way for how the technology can use to explore and enhance the effectiveness of on-screen relationships. It's a documentary called Pina.
Oh, my gosh.
About Pina Bausch.
I totally thought it would be Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
And her Tanztheater Wuppertal from director Wim Wenders, who started to work with Pina a few days before her death and continued to make this documentary using some footage, some historic footage, but also recreating some of her most famous stage performances
with
the original dancers with the dance company, and then also taking those dancers out and explaining or showing why they do what they do. And these dancers, they reveal what their relationship was to Pina, what their relationship is to dance, what their relationship is to art, why they do what they do, what they've learned through all this. They talk about it a little bit, but really they dance about it.
They explain it through
dance. They go out into the world, into public places, and demonstrate all of these things through dance.
Isn't that great?
It is such a celebration of the human body and human movement, not as embodied by professional dancers, but by showing what we're all capable of.
Ah.
And again, as I said a couple weeks ago, 25 years ago, Wim Wenders made the film that made me want to be a filmmaker. 25 years later, he makes a film that really inspires me to become
a dancer.
As healthy as I possibly
can,
and to really explore and enjoy using my body.
Look at that. Well, there you go.
A quarter hour more of your Chill Pack
Hollywood
Hour. We just gave
15 minutes more of your Chill Pack.
Then ever give till it hurts. That's our motto.
25% more.
Let's forego the usual closing song.
We know it.
And let's just say you can find so many episodes again at chillpackhollywood.com.
Yep.
You can write us chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Please do. We'll be back to answering your emails and talking about everything that's going on in the world next week.
Yes.
Follow Dean on Twitter.
I'm at D. Haglin.
And I'm at Phil Larinus. Be a liker of the show on Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Awesome. See ya.
Belated spoiler alert.